today is at war in Afghanistan.
The war opponents are much more passionate about their cause.
It's at war throughout Central Asia.
Election day. It's a lot of stuff in the balance, politically speaking.
It's at war in the Philippines.
There are wars that the American public and its demands that the government goes and fights, and then there are wars that the government demands that the American people support, and this is really the latter.
It's at war in Indonesia. We're at war in Pakistan.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, November 5th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is the day in history that helps define politically who we are as a nation. When the polls are closed and the ballots are counted at the end of the day, we'll know whether political power rests further in the hands of conservative Republican officials or whether Americans want to tilt more control to Democratic or progressive forces. It's called democracy. It's what our ancestors have fought and died for. But how is this electoral system serving us as a nation? Are the wishes of the voters really getting expressed in the system, such as it is? Are the candidates reflecting your will? Or do you feel as though your interests are at best only nominally represented? Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace and the host of Spirit in Action, a talk show on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington's nation's capital, invited voter feedback and raised questions about developing a new electoral system. He spoke with U.S. Representative John Conyers and Ron Walters, a political scientist in the Washington area.
I talked to a friend of mine this morning in Maryland who said to me, Damu, I'm not going out to vote today because I don't have anybody to vote for. And I really don't feel that my choice, that there are good choices in the race. And here's what I want to just say about it, and I'd like to have you all respond. In some instances around the country, the choices really are between, with the quality of candidates, Tweeter-Dee, Tweeter-Dum, and Tweeter-Dum-Dum. Now, I know the strategic importance of sometime voting for the lesser of two evils, so I won't get into that discussion right now. But a lot of people are really feeling, I've talked to a lot of people over the last few days, really feeling that in some congressional districts and some local elections, that there's nobody that they feel will really be able to come in and represent them effectively. So they feel that they don't really want to go to the poll because there's no real progressive alternative. How do you all respond to that, Dr. Walters?
Well, I think that when we look at the structure of American electorate and the political system, I think and compare it to Europe, the multi-party system seems to produce higher turnout because people turn out to vote for some party with which it is ideological consistent. Here we have a challenge, really, quite frankly, of turning out to vote for parties sometimes about whom we are not ideologically consistent, and who might present candidates that really don't speak to our issues. So what we have to do, I think, is, and those multi-party systems in Europe produce a turnout which is average 85% in Europe. In this country, now we're in the 40s. So when you look at what we have to do, I think we have to elevate the focus of the agenda over the personalities. I think that's our challenge. Because we're going to get what I call a structure of choice. Nine times out of ten, that's imperfect if you're just looking at the candidates. And so what our battle has to be is what is the candidate focus? What are the issues? What is that struggle all about? And I think if we can get people to focus on the issues rather than the personalities, then I think we can produce higher turnouts, as we have done. I mean, one thing you can say about the black vote in America, when it perceives that its interest is at stake, not the personality, when it perceives that its interest is at stake, it has consistently turned out in very high numbers. And that is the message that we have to get across.
And John Conyers. John, you were going to say something.
You know, Ron Walters always leaves me with a page full of notes whenever he starts out. And it's really a pleasure to be on the program with him. Because we are not likely to get the European multi-party system going, I have argued with Ralph Nader as recently as yesterday on WBAI that he would be more influential inside the Democratic Party, where we have 55 progressive members, 38 members of the CBC, 17 members of the Hispanic Caucus. We have an environmental caucus. We have a human rights caucus. Then he would be increasing, making it more difficult for us to increase our numbers in places where there are progressive forces at work. And I think that's something we have to begin to grapple with a little bit more directly. A lot of our Democratic leaders are scared stiff of the Green Party and the challenges they present, when there are others of us who say we ought to be embracing those values and bringing in more people rather than trying to pretend they don't exist.
Congressman, we have a couple of calls on that. Robert, you're on the air.
Good morning. There's a lot of issues here today, but my quick question to the gentlemen are, in particular, Mr. Walters, is you're supposed to be someone who's fair in terms of looking at these issues. And what I want to hear, and I think what a lot of people want to hear, is how do we begin to prepare young people coming up to be both Republican and Democrat? The world is changing. The United States is changing in terms of color. And if we prepare people to be on both sides of the aisle, we will begin to get what we want. I think what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds as though we're still putting out a message that we're victims, and we've got to stop doing that and prepare our people to take control of what's going on.
All right, Robert, thank you so much. Dr. Walters?
Well, let me just make a point in support of what John has said and extend it, because the media is not about to let, I think, any clear-headed analysis get through with respect to these issues. And how many times have you heard that the black vote is going to make the difference, and yet there is no analysis of the black vote that people can see the power of that vote? John Conyers, I have not seen him on ABC, CBS, CNN, and he is the senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus in the United States of America, and yet we don't get a chance to join in that dialogue and talk about how potent this vote is. Everybody acknowledges it. So that's one thing. Final point I would make, young man, I am not concerned about making Democrats or Republicans. I am more concerned about people who have a progressive outlook on the world, people who have a set of values that are protective of human life, that seek to move our community forward, and have a set of agenda items that comport with that worldview. Now, if you have that, and we don't live in a perfect world, then you can make your political choice between Democrats and Republicans, which is to say you start out with a criteria, and then you choose a party, not the other way around. So I'm not interested in making either one or the other, because there are times when on certain issues Republicans are right. Most of the time, as far as I'm concerned, Democrats are right. But I start with my criteria. That's where I want you to start.
Political analyst Ronald Walters is a professor at the University of Maryland. Also on the program, U.S. Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. In a subsequent interview with Lifetime Democrat and former presidential candidate Jesse Jackson, host Damu Smith asked Jackson about the significance of today's midterm elections.
Reverend Jackson, at a time when the Bush administration is marching towards war and the economy seems to be in a tailspin, why have these midterm elections emerged as such a strategic and important election?
They're strategic in that if Democrats maintain the Senate, then people like Tom Daschle, who have some view of the economy and balance, will remain in power, will have some sense of fair judges. But if, in fact, Democrats lose the Senate, it re-empowers Trent Lott to be head of the Senate and Orrin Hatch. And they have a very, very focused right-wing Confederate agenda. But that comes a whole body of judges who are lax on the environment, lax on public policy when it comes to working poor people, the environment, and foreign policy. So in some sense, this campaign is about Daschle versus Trent Lott. It's about Ted Kennedy versus Orrin Hatch. On the other hand, on the House side, if Democrats regain the House, 40 African-American congresspeople will be empowered in some greater measure. The Haitians who are being sent back to Haiti with great risk. If John Conyers were head of Judiciary Committee, he would hold hearings, and they would stay here. And those who are in Haiti would get the aid that has been cut off from them. Charlie Rang would be chair of House Ways and Means. And so in many ways, this campaign is about the Senate, and it's about the House. And if you have those persons in power, they're less likely to go to war without some compelling reason, and more likely to focus on our economy.
A lot of people, there are some people who are saying that the political process in America is really not serving the electorate when, A, thousands of people called in to the House and Senate several weeks ago urging them to vote against the Iraq war resolution pushed by the Bush administration, and yet they were ignored. And B, some people are saying that in many instances around the country in these races, the choice is between Tweedledee, Tweedledum, and Tweedledum-dum, and why should they even bother to come out and vote? What is your response to that?
I think that kind of talk discourages real live options. Number one, tomorrow morning, either Trent Lott or Daschle will head the Senate. That is a big difference. That is not Tweedledee or Tweedledum. That's a big difference. Tomorrow, you're going to have Charlie Rangel empowered and Gephardt empowered. You're going to have Hassett empowered. And if Bush has Trent Lott as chair of the Senate and the committees and has Hassett head the House, it spells doomsday big time. So we should not tell people that's not different. That is a huge difference. You cannot take a single issue, even though it's a critical one, and make that the pivotal point for all other votes. I would say to you, if we regain the House and Senate, we'll have a tremendous capacity to stop this war. If we lose the House and Senate, we have no chance of stopping it.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson on WPFW's Spirit in Action, hosted by Damu Smith. The recent vote on the president's war resolution has become a key issue in this election for some progressives. But how is it playing at the polls? Michelle Goldberg, staff writer for Salon.com, wrote an article entitled, Wellstone Was Right. During a discussion with Goldberg earlier today, she explains that politicians who voted against Bush's Iraq resolution were supposed to pay a harsh political price. Instead, they're thriving on the campaign trail.
Part of it is that there's a history of this. I mean, if you look at even the 2000 election, the overwhelming consensus in kind of Washington pundit circles was that George Bush was going to win the popular vote. They seemed to assume that the American people found him as utterly charming as, for some baffling reason, they did. Now, if you look at people keep saying that there's wide support for George Bush,
yes,
even though there's been very few articles about the kind of precipitous drop in his polling numbers. His job performance rating is actually way down. Mm. And if you look at the numbers of people who support an invasion of Iraq, have actually gone down quite a bit. I think it's now around 55%. As soon as you add any kind of conditions to that, for instance, what if we don't have our allies' support? What if there are significant American casualties? What if we need to stay in the country for at least a year? I mean, all of those things are kind of quite real possibilities or likelihoods. The numbers go down to around 27, 26%. So that's about 75% of the people opposed to the course that George Bush seems to be staking out right now.
So now how does that translate into campaign races in today's election? You said that, I know you interviewed and researched a number of candidacies, one in particular, Senator Dick Durbin in Illinois, who is a Democrat.
Certainly.
Who voted against Bush's war resolution. What did you find to be the case there?
Well, I mean, these things vary regionally, but if you look at his region, it's not even necessarily that the people who are passionate, that war opponents necessarily outnumber those who would support a war, as much as that the war opponents are much more passionate about their cause. There's very few passionate war proponents, which is why he said, you know, that just people everywhere he goes, in a way that's never happened to him before in decades of political service, are coming up to him and thanking him for their vote, thanking him for his vote. The calls to his office have been overwhelmingly positive, and his polling numbers are overwhelmingly positive. I mean, he's leading by 18% right now.
But now when you say that people aren't passionate about voting in favor of the war, that seems a little odd to me. I mean, my feeling is that a large part of the American population feels like, you know, they're behind our president.
They're behind our president, certainly. But what I'm saying is that there's very few Americans who are demanding that we go to war. This is something that George Bush is saying we have to do, and there's a great many people who are willing to give him a benefit of the doubt. But there are wars that the American public, and it demands that the government goes and fights, and then there are wars that the government demands that the Americans, that the American people support, and this is really the latter. So there's no kind of pro-war constituency outside, you know, some very small hawkish circles. It's more a constituency that is willing to support the president given his insistence that this is an extension of the war on terrorism. And that in itself keeps breaking down as, you know, we read more and more reports about the total absence of a link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda.
Now, how widespread is your research?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is just basically a review of the polls. And it's also talking to candidates, and a lot of this is very anecdotal because, like I said, the sentiment in Washington State is going to be quite different from the sentiment in Texas. And as I said in my article, most of the congressmen who voted against this resolution were already in fairly liberal districts. So they were really representing their constituencies in a way that somebody who might have voted against this resolution in Texas wouldn't be. But what I kept hearing was the same thing over and over again, whether you're talking about people in Chicago, in Illinois, whether you're talking about people in Vermont, whether you're talking about people in Washington State, in California. Everybody was getting these phone calls that were 100, 200, 1,000 to 1 against the war. And every single person I talked to said that they had never seen a response like that to any other issue in all their time in public office.
And you quote Senator Durbin in your article saying that he was actually stopped on the street.
Not only stopped in the street, he was actually stopped while he was down on his knees in church taking communion, which apparently is something that is just not done. But someone stopped next to him in the aisle and said, you know, Senator Durbin, stick with Robert Byrd on Iraq.
Michelle Goldberg, author of Wellstone, was right, an article on Saturday's edition of Salon.com. Well, what do the elections mean to youth in the nation's capital? Reem Kathuda took our mics to Bar None, where every Monday night young Washingtonians gather to drop some tunes, poems, and raps.
You know I'm proud to be black, y'all, and that's a fact, y'all. And if you try to take what's mine, I take it back, y'all. It's like that.
It's election day. A lot of stuff in the balance, politically speaking, and also the pending war on Iraq.
Our ancestors really fought hard so that we could be out here voting. So please make your voice be heard. It only takes about 5-10 minutes. It's not a lot of your time. It's really a difference.
You can hear it loud and clear, like when the school bell rings. Like Martin Luther King, I will do my thing. I'll say it in a rap, cause I do not sing.
The anti-war rally a week and some change ago, they came into town. There were like 250,000 people in town. There were buses here from 40 different states. It's like one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in forever, since Vietnam. That's some major stuff. It's kind of like letting y'all know, you know, like, hey, a lot of people don't really agree with the policies of the pirate presidency that's in office currently.
DMC, the man that's crossing the street. I got a message for the world, so listen up, it's brief. Like Malcolm X said, I won't turn a right cheek. Got the strength to go to length if you want to start beef, start beef.
I was reading the Word today, and I happened to come across a scripture that said, let revenge be the Lord's, because he'll take care of that a lot better than any of us will. Better than any gun, better than any bad thing we got to say. And just for real, let revenge be the Lord's in everything that we do. I'm getting emotional.
How long will it take Hollywood to make a Bin Laden videotape? Long enough for U.S. oil corporations to have the excuses needed to convince the world that they deserve the world's oil reserves. You see, this thing has been going on since at least the early 80s, when every movie that was moved out of Universal Studios was an attempt to make Arabs in the Middle East look more shady. Whether Rambo or Delta Force, from Sylvester Stallone to Chuck Norris, the onslaught of those of Middle Eastern descent has been caught on tape. Kind of take me back to the days of the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the attack was aimed at young blacks. And every movie then that was tipped out of Tinseltown had some young black face behind some vial of crack, whether selling it or bipping it, whether smoking it or distributing it. The world's understanding of us being focused through some director's lenses, lending opinions of our image that was more than offensive. And 10 years after the first showing of New Jack City, King of New York, Minister Society, and others, the American prison population had doubled, with 85% of those looking like there for committing the crimes that they saw in those flicks. 85% of those there looking like a younger version of my pops. 85% of those people there inebriated from the films that they stayed up all night and saw, but apparently they didn't watch. They didn't study the impact of Superfly or the Mac. They just didn't get it. They didn't understand that before you destroy your people, take their resources and confiscate their wealth, you must ensure that the world does not see them in the same vein that they see themselves. See, they must look like monsters. So to justify the destruction of Russia, they shot the original Mission Impossible in Maxwell Smart. And to set the stage for the demise of their own Bill Clinton, they shot Primary Colors and Wag the Dog, as always the same strategies. Make a video, demonize your enemies, and for some reason my consciousness is telling me that a bird in the hand is worth more than the words of George Bush. And I'm not the biggest fan of Jesse Jackson, but I question thoroughly the actions of an administration who, just for the record, would steal an entire election from the world's quote-unquote most intelligent intellectuals. I argue that the driving force behind these military strikes is oil, disguised as a war on terrorism. And those states slated as a terrorist states are the states that state that a puppet state, they're just not going to have it. So there's a need for regime change, with their leadership slated for removal, with the new dependent upon the approval of some international oil mongrel. We must be honest. Ever since these cats have taken office, the cost of gas has been god-awful. Even our personal problems stemming from oil rigging. See, they won't sleep unless they control the cost of heat and all your dough blown from just driving home to the babysitter, multiplied by looking for the job that you used to have, but you don't have because the economy has now plunged into a depression. And so that we won't second guess W's ability to drive the economy straight, they justify war to send up the president's approval rating. And how do I know? I saw it on tape. This is how they get down. The cost is always live to turn U.S. finances around. It's a sad state of affairs, but I swear this is how it is. Blockbuster, the number one promoter of U.S. propaganda, and you will play daily, even weekly, to weaken those who you do not yet see, but eventually you will see as your enemy.
Peace. Regardless of tomorrow's political outcome, we still have a duty to support each other and our business endeavors, because business is war. And until we get our economics together, the politics can only take us so far. Business is war.
Born son of Byford, brother of Al. Bangs my mama and runs my pal. It's McDaniels, not McDonald's. These rhymes are Darryl's, those burgers are
Ronald's.
I ran down my family. My mother, my father, my brother, and D.
They're building weapons of destruction. It's against the Ark of the Covenant. These descendants of dark angels disguised as the government. Rightfully, they'll never be here to the riches. So they're building tall towers and they're making deep ditches. But he who digs the pit into the same, he's going to fall. And when they're down that low, who are they going to call? 911, it ain't a joke no more. So they bomb the Taliban just to even the score. See, a wicked man will flee when no one pursueth. Come running after me because I be teaching y'all the truth.
We got a friend of ours in tonight from Pacifica Radio. Pacifica is the company that manages all those stations.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Katkhuda.
Peace proponent Dr. Joseph Gerson of the American Friends Service Committee spoke in Boston recently. He addressed America's military budget and compared it to that of Germany in the 1930s.
The United States today is at war in Afghanistan. It's at war throughout Central Asia. It's at war in the Philippines. It's at war in Indonesia. We're at war in Pakistan. Our military budget in the last year has gone up $100 billion. Our military budget today equals that of the next 25 biggest military spenders in the world combined. The increase of the U.S. military budget is equal to the highest military budget of any nation in the world. To get a sense of who we are, how the rest of the world sees us. It's important, I think, to understand that while oil is an important part of what's going on, this is ultimately about a war about empire. It's a war about, as Cheney said before 9/11, as he said before 9/11, this is a war about imposing the arrangement for the 21st century. Oil is a significant part about it. As Wolfowitz says, teaching the world to fear us is an important part of the lesson. Breaking out of the UN order is an important part of the lesson. Disciplining the U.S. people is an important part of the lesson. Condoleezza Rice has said that this period now is comparable to the period between 1945 and 1947. That's the period in which the Cold War was imposed on the United States and on the world, internationally but also domestically. Think in terms of McCarthyism. Think in terms of what happened in the university. Think in terms of what happened to our economy and to our budgets. So I think we need to understand, if you will, the truly fundamental importance of this moment. I think what we heard from all of the speakers thus far, among other things, is that this war is not an aberration. Vietnam wasn't an aberration. It comes out of this long history. And yet, at the same time, we are in a critical moment here where a group that captured power in the United States are attempting to consolidate power, something far, far more powerful than the Roman Empire, than the British Empire, than the U.S. Empire of the first two centuries. I think we just need to face that and to understand the importance of the moment. My frame of reference we have many frames of reference, but for me, much of it is from Auschwitz. What do we expect the people of Europe to have done in that period? There was a big crisis, kind of brouhaha, not long ago when the justice minister in Germany made comparisons to between the United States at this time and Nazi Germany. Friends, this is not an aberration. People all over the world are saying this. Before 9/11, I had a meeting with a senior European diplomat involved with Asia policy. This is well before 9/11. And he says, the United States has got too much power now. It reminds me of Germany in the 30s. He didn't say Germany in the 40s. He said Germany in the 30s. But think about that and think about our responsibilities. Let me then, with not enough time here, kind of point and grunt into some of the things that we can do. I mean, there's the question that Lenin asked, what then must be done? And there's lots of answers to that question. Since September 11th, I would say the U.S. peace movement has had essentially four main foundations. One is to be very clear that those attacks were indiscriminate crimes and that those responsible for them must be brought to justice. We do need to maintain the security of our society. But the second point is that war is not the answer. I mean, even the former head of the MI5 in England is telling us this is not how you deal with terrorism. With terrorism, you deal with your police powers within your constitution, intelligence, within international law and with respect to constitutional law, the use of diplomacy, a lot of patience.
Dr. Joseph Gerson of the American Friends Service Committee. You're listening to Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.